Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, May 4th. I'm Carrie Craig. We'll start with the front page of the Gazette today. Article titled, For Xavier Prom, It's Dancing on My Own. And there's a picture of Troy Williams of Cedar Rapids, who is also known as DJ Commando. So the picture is him sitting kind of in the dark in the school lobby entryway of Xavier with all his DJ equipment in front of him, bright red headphones on, and some disco lights shining. So even though he's DJing prom by himself, he's got his lights going too. Other pictures with the article include the principal of Xavier sitting at a desk, dancing with her arms up in the air and a big smile. And then another photo showing how the homecoming court is on a grand march video. So it's a computer screen showing different smaller pictures of the kids who are on the homecoming court. So go ahead with the article. This is by Molly Duffy for the Gazette. DJ Commando live streams from school to living rooms. Prom night at Xavier High School was nearly empty and nearly silent, save for the whir of lights and the dim sounds escaping from the DJ's headphones. Welcome to Xavier Prom 2020, Troy Williams, aka DJ Commando, said to a camera that was focused on him for a live-streamed virtual prom Saturday night. On the other side of the feed were many of the high school juniors and seniors who otherwise would have been dancing closely that night at the private Catholic high school in Cedar Rapids. Instead, they were at home, at their dinner tables, and on their couches, congregating in the school gym to crown a prom king and queen. Like all school gatherings this spring, was made impossible by the coronavirus pandemic. The only people actually at prom were the DJ, the camera-shy principal, the school's communications director, and a producer. They aired a pre-produced reveal of the prom king and queen, Nick Fisher and Kate Tucker, before jumping to a live feed of Principal Angela Olson in a Zoom meeting with three teachers and a student. In quotes, as Jerry Brown was of Blue Sky Productions and a Xavier dad, saying, Mrs. Moses, you have any requests for the night? As he crawled behind her chair to invisibly adjust her sound levels. After communications director Nick Ireland threw the feed to DJ Commando, she sighed, in quotes, there are a lot of things we've never done before that are happening this year, end quote. For students, too, virtual prom wasn't something they could have imagined. Watching from home in shorts and a t-shirt, Tucker said it didn't feel quite real watching her photo pop up on the screen to reveal she'd won prom queen, an announcement that usually would be made in a gym packed with teachers, families, and her friends. But she was more excited than sad, Tucker said, and was glad to share the moment with her parents and siblings. In quotes, she said, I couldn't have imagined a global pandemic would hit, but it happens, end quote. Fisher was similarly casual when he found out he was the class of 2020's prom king. In quotes, he said, my mom tried to make me dress up. I said no, end quote. Back at school, Ireland and Brown were switching from shots of the DJ to ones of the Zoom meeting, where teachers and their own children were dancing to songs by Bruno Mars, Lizzo, and Fergie. A handful of students joined the Zoom meeting, partying on their back porches or in their bedrooms. Emily Moses, an English teacher, turned disco lights on in her living room and lip-synced throughout the 90-minute feed. Taylor Co-Star, who was on the prom court, said in quotes, it was nice teachers cared enough to take their time and do that. It was weird watching it instead of being part of it, but I'm glad we got to do something for it, end quote. For the cha-cha slide, Ireland ran out to do the choreographed dance with Williams, who was until then sliding to the left all by himself on the live stream. In quotes, he said, my kids are going to be so embarrassed, end quote. Even online, some parts of prom remained the same. When a student appeared on the live stream in a black dress with a slit up the side, Olson lovingly scolded her. Ireland sweated over the lyrical contents of T-Pain's Apple Bottom Jeans. Teachers in chat room wished they had a drink. Ella Schulte, another member of the court, said in quotes, it was a nice way to have a little bit of closure to our senior year. Even though we didn't expect it to be this way, it was nice to have that moment with everybody, end quote. And virtual prom, she added, was a unique opportunity for her older family members. Her grandparents, who wouldn't have been able to physically travel to her school, were some of the nearly 150 people who watched. Despite losing many of the senior year experiences they planned to have this year, Ireland, who let out a big sigh of relief when the prom live stream wrapped around 8:15 p.m., said he's been struck by students' response to the pandemic and related cancellations. In quotes, he said, Quite frankly, I think they've been more resilient than some of the adults during this time. They're coping with some of these heartbreaking moments that they're not being able to experience, and still finding a way to move forward and find joy in some of these unexpected areas. It gives me hope that they're going to be okay. End quote. Our next article is also from the front page of the Gazette today. Iowa federal court prepares for juries. Grand jury could resume this month. Jury trials in June. This is by Trish Mahaffey for the Gazette. Out of Cedar Rapids, federal court officials have made contingency plans to go forward with grand jury proceedings after May 11th and possibly trials that are on the docket after June 1st, but there will be safety precautions in place. Robert Phelps, administrator of the U.S. Northern District of Iowa, said Chief Judge Leonard Strand has amended a previous order on federal grand juries and trial juries, but it's dependent on recommendations from Governor Kim Reynolds, public health officials, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Restrictions on group sizes and social distancing for Linn and Woodbury counties, where both Northern District courthouses are located, haven't been lifted. Reynolds' orders affecting these counties expire May 15th unless she changes them by then. Phelps said if a grand jury is called later this month, the courts have enough space for social distancing. The grand jurors serve 2-year terms and have already been selected. In quotes, Phelps said, "The plan is to move the proceedings into one of the largest courtrooms we have so that everyone is a minimum of 6 feet apart. A grand jury of 16 to 20 people will be spaced out in whatever courtroom we use." End quote. Because the public isn't allowed in the courtroom during grand jury proceedings. Phelps said he and jury administrators have been talking with members of the grand jury about the precautions they plan to take to protect their health and provide a safe environment. In another quote, he said, "Most people understand the serious nature of the judicial process, appreciate the extra steps we are taking for their protection, and are ready to serve whenever we move forward." End quote. Phelps acknowledged a few jurors expressed concern. He said court officials will look at which jurors fall into the most at-risk categories established by the CDC, and some could be excused from serving. A grand jury requires 16 impartial people to listen to evidence and witnesses presented by a prosecutor who lays out an outline of the case. The jurors then vote on whether they believe there's probable cause to indict or charge a person with a federal crime. Phelps said grand jurors would be asked to wear masks as long as restrictions are in place. The court would provide one if a grand juror didn't already have one that is appropriate. The custodial staff has been doing an excellent job of sanitizing and doing extra cleanings throughout the federal courthouses in Cedar Rapids and Sioux City, he said. If jury trials go forward starting in June, the same basic guidelines for social distancing and sanitizing of courthouses will be followed. Phelps said 12 jurors and 2 alternates for a criminal trial would be spaced apart in the jury box, and chairs would be added in front of it. During jury selection, the prospective jurors not in the immediate panel being questioned would be seated in 2 or more other courtrooms to allow social distancing and could watch a live stream of the selection process. Strand, in his order, said if the defense or prosecution wants a continuance of a trial set for June 1st or after due to public health concerns, the presiding judge would have discretion to consider the request. And now to the Iowa Today page. Democratic Senate hopefuls target Ernst in virtual forum. This is by James Q. Lynch for the Gazette. Out of Cedar Rapids, Democrats running for their party's U.S. Senate nomination agreed that an assault weapons ban should be reinstated, but that didn't stop them from taking shots at their common target, Senator Joni Ernst. Not only does Ernst oppose reestablishing the assault weapons ban that was in place from 1994 to 2004, but the first-term Republican is on the wrong side of healthcare, climate change, agriculture, and energy issues, the 5 Democrats argued in the Prime the Primary virtual forum Sunday afternoon, hosted by Democratic parties in Benton, Iowa, and Poweshiek counties. The Democrats are running, as retired Admiral Mike Franken said, to, in quotes, "negate the things that got Joni Ernst elected to begin with," end quotes. It's ironic that Ernst's Make 'em Squeal campaign ad propelled her to victory in 2014, attorney Kimberly Graham said. Rather than take on the special interests, the Democrat said, she has been the tool of corporate interests and fallen in line with President Donald Trump, whose policies on agriculture, trade, and renewable fuels have hurt Iowans. Asked about health care, specifically rural health care, Graham said that by voting to end the Affordable Care Act and protections for pre-existing conditions, Ernst, in quotes, has not been a friend of regular Iowans, end quote. Graham said she's the only candidate in the field who supports a universal single-payer healthcare system because it's, in quote, the only way that we are going to get healthcare that is truly acceptable, end quote. The COVID-19 crisis has, in quote from Des Moines businesswoman Teresa Greenfield, put a spotlight on the inequities in our healthcare, and in particular when it comes to our rural healthcare systems, end quote. Greenfield called for strengthening the Affordable Care Act and adding a public option. Ernst's opposition to Obamacare, in a quote from Greenfield, would end Medicaid expansion, which would threaten so many of our rural hospitals, end quote. Des Moines businessman Eddie Morrow called for a Peace Corps-like domestic healthcare program to recruit new and retired healthcare professionals to work in rural Iowa and other underserved areas. As a senator, Morrow said he would lead hearings on the privatization of Medicaid, which he called, in quotes, particularly devastating for rural Iowa. Also in quotes, he said, COVID-19 has also demonstrated that we must make sure that healthcare is there for every American. A massive public health care plan that provides health care for all Americans because it's a human right, end quote. Much of America's health care problem stems from the fact that 62 cents of every health care dollar is spent on things other than direct patient care, Des Moines businessman Cal Woods said. 20 cents is spent on marketing and advertising and on salaries at for-profit insurance companies, he said. Another 12 cents is wasted because of overpaying for prescription drugs. The U.S. could have a world-class healthcare system if Congress would, in quote, allocate money away from insurance companies, away from administrative costs, and away from the amount that we overpaid for pharmaceuticals, end quote. The primary election is June 2nd. Also on the Iowa Today page, House GOP leader backs Miller Meeks in 2nd District race. This is also by James Q. Lynch for the Gazette. Out of Cedar Rapids, State Senator Marionette Miller Meeks' bid for the Republican nomination in Iowa's 2nd District has been endorsed by the party's leader in the U.S. House. California Representative Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, has endorsed Miller Meeks as someone who, in quotes, represents the goals, interests, and aspirations of the people, end quote, of the 24-county district that includes Johnson, Muscatine, and Scott counties. In quotes, McCarthy said, her hard work and dedication to service are needed more than ever to flip this Democrat-held seat for the people. Candidates like Marionette will help us regain control of the People's House and give President Trump a Congress that works with him each day rather than obstructs his every move to strengthen our economy, secure our borders, and make healthcare more affordable and accessible to working families, end quote. His endorsement speaks volumes about the importance of the 2nd District in Republicans' effort to regain the House majority, Miller Meeks said. In quotes, she said, he knows I'll never quit fighting for conservative principles, and I'll never give up on the people of Iowa. His support is a clear message to Iowa and the rest of the country that the people of the 2nd District have an extraordinary opportunity to reshape our country's future by standing with me on June 2nd and again in November, end quote. Miller Meeks, an Army veteran and ophthalmologist, is in a five-way race for the GOP nomination. The other candidates are Tim Borchard of Iowa City, Stephen Everly of Knoxville, Rick Phillips of Pella, and Bobby Schilling of LeClaire. The winner will face Democrat Rita Hart of Wheatland, a former state senator. The winner will claim the 2nd District seat held by Democratic Rep. Dave Loebsack, who is not seeking re-election. The 2nd District is rated a toss-up, according to a national political forecast. It's the country's only open Democratic-held district that President Donald Trump carried in 2016. And from the top stories of the Iowa Today section under Capital Ideas, poll, Iowans back Reynolds on response, but fewer back Trump. This is by Aaron Murphy for the Gazette. Iowans, and many Americans it seems, feel their governors are doing a better job handling the coronavirus pandemic than is President Donald Trump. Here at home, more than half of Iowans approve of the job Republican Governor Kim Reynolds is doing in guiding the state's response to the pandemic, a poll shows. New polling published this past week showed 54% of Iowans approve of the way Reynolds is handling the coronavirus outbreak. The same poll showed 46% of Iowans had the same opinion of Trump. The polling was conducted by researchers from Harvard Kennedy School, Northeastern University, and Rutgers University. The researchers surveyed almost 23,000 individuals from April 17th to 26th across 50 states and the District of Columbia. Iowans are not alone in showing more faith in their governor than the president. In fact, survey respondents in all 50 states gave their governor a better coronavirus response approval rating than the president. But Iowa's approval gap is not nearly as wide as it is elsewhere. In New York, for example, 74% of people said they approve of the job Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo is doing in handling the pandemic, while just 40% said the same of Trump. New York has been one of the hardest hit states by the virus. In an effort to limit the coronavirus spread through the state, Reynolds ordered Iowa schools closed and some businesses closed entirely or partially. Starting last week, she lifted some of those restrictions on some businesses in parts of the state that have not been as hard hit by the virus. As of Sunday, 184 Iowans have died from the coronavirus, and 9,169 positive cases have been confirmed, according to state public health data. The numbers continue to climb in Iowa. 3 days last week set new single-day highs for virus-related deaths. Just 25% of Iowans said they disapprove of how Reynolds has managed the pandemic. 20% offered no opinion. Roughly 3 in 5 Iowans polled said state government is reacting about right to the pandemic. 32% said the state is not taking the outbreak seriously enough. And just 8% said the state is overreacting, the poll found. Trust in city government was even higher. Nearly 4 in 5 Iowans said they have a lot or some trust in their city government to do the right thing in managing the virus, according to the poll. Iowans also remain supportive of state-ordered mitigation efforts that required many businesses to close. Roughly 4 in 5 Iowans strongly or somewhat approve of business closures to prevent the disease's spread, while just 1 in 5 strongly or somewhat disapprove, according to the results. Those numbers are strong across the country and across political parties, the poll found. In quotes, David Laser, a professor of political science and computer and information sciences at Northeastern University, said, "People are highly supportive of the social distancing measures. They're not ready to reopen the economy yet. And this is pretty much a bipartisan consensus." End quote. And now we turn to the Insight page. This article is a guest column written by Drew Martell. So Drew Martell is the director of crisis services at Foundation 2 and has been involved in several suicide risk assessments as well as provided trainings across the state on suicide intervention and treatment. Drew also provides individual therapy at Meadowlark Psychiatric Services and is an adjunct instructor at the University of Iowa School of Social Work. So Drew's guest column is titled "Have Hope: Suicide in Times of Crisis." And it starts with a quote from William Styron: "It is hopelessness even more than pain that crushes the soul." So Drew begins, "In my 35 years on Earth, I've heard the term unprecedented used only a handful of times to describe global events. I don't know about you, but as I write this tucked away in my basement where I've been working the last 2 months, I'm pretty darn sick of the word unprecedented. All of us are now experiencing the culmination of a global pandemic, a painful economic reality, and the challenge of stay-at-home orders. Social connectedness is one of the most important aspects of the human condition. During times of crisis, we come together, not apart. Time spent with friends and family is immensely important to our well-being. Heck, even time spent with coworkers has its benefits. Physical proximity to our supports matters. It matters a lot. For those of us with a history of mental health struggles and without, this unprecedented crisis has presented unique challenges to our well-being. Uncertainty, fear, and a sense of hopelessness. The daily loss of life, the 24-hour news cycle with its constant focus on the pandemic and a massive economic crisis, good news is hard to come by." The psychologist and suicidologist Edwin Schneidman coined the term psychological pain to describe, in quotes, "how much you hurt as a human. It is mental suffering, mental torment," end quote. All of us hurt right now. During times of stress, it is not uncommon to experience thoughts of suicide. The vast majority of individuals who experience suicidal thoughts or behaviors go on to live healthy and full lives. During this time where many of us have already felt financial impacts or experienced increased depression, the possibility of experiencing suicidal ideation or behavior increases. Support is available. Help there. Number one, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255, to immediately speak with a counselor 24/7, 365. If you are thinking about suicide, are worried about someone else, or would like emotional support, the Lifeline Network is available. Number two, mobile crisis outreach. If you live in Eastern Iowa, you can call the Iowa Helpline, 855-581-8111, to receive free telehealth services from a mobile crisis counselor. Counselors will connect with you to provide screening, immediate intervention, and guidance. There are several warning signs that can help you determine if you or a loved one is at risk for suicide. These include talking about wanting to die or to kill themselves, looking for a way to kill themselves like purchasing a firearm, talking about feeling hopeless or having no reason to live, talking about feeling trapped or in unbearable pain, or talking about being a burden to others. Three, social distancing does not mean social isolation. While we can't be physically with many of our friends and family, we should still make an effort to connect with them. If there is someone you've worried about in the past, a friend or family member with a history of depression, now is an important time to reach out and see how they are doing. Number four, take care of what you can. I've noticed with many of the clients I work with and myself that as social distancing has been in place for nearly 2 months now, sleep habits and routines have started to change. I find myself staying up later and sleeping in later. Sleep and mental health go hand in hand. It's hard to feel good when we are not sleeping. Depression can drive us to want to sleep away the days. This is something to be avoided and tends to compound our feelings of loneliness. Number five, connect with your mental health providers. Connecting with a mental health provider remains an important component of support. Let your provider know that you've had thoughts of suicide so you can work collaboratively on treatment and support. Number six, know that you matter. Individuals who experience thoughts of suicide and/or depression will often report that they feel or think their lives don't matter. As Kevin Hines, the motivational speaker and suicide prevention advocate, says in quotes, "You matter to people you haven't even met yet," end quote. Treatment for suicide ideation and behavior is very effective. You are worth it. The vast majority of people who experience suicide ideation go on to live healthy and fulfilling lives. And then he ends with another quote from Marcus Aurelius from the Meditations. "Look well into thyself. There is a source of strength which will always spring up if thou wilt always look." And another guest column from the Insight page. This one is from Don Ratcheter. Don is a retired political scientist, founder and former president of the Iowa Association of Political Scientists, and serves on the National Taxpayers Union's Board of Directors. Don's guest column is entitled, "Top Federal Regulators Are Helping Iowa." In the second half of March, the economic havoc wrought by the coronavirus forced nearly 100,000 Iowans to file for unemployment benefits, a record. President Donald Trump and Congress have responded by passing a $2 trillion economic relief package, which, along with financial support for individuals, provides a financial lifeline for small businesses forced to shutter because of COVID-19. But there are other ways to help struggling families during this challenging time. For example, thanks to the efforts of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, many Iowans that have seen significant increases in their utility bills during the shutdown will soon benefit from at-cost renewable energy. FERC is stepping up to reform the outdated law known as the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, or PURPA, which needlessly inflates the price paid for renewable energy. The agency has said it is proceeding full steam ahead despite the coronavirus crisis. Iowans who have the fifth highest per capita energy consumption rate in the nation know the importance of getting consumers relief from this costly law. PURPA is a product of a bygone era. After the 1973 Arab oil embargo, Congress created the act to promote conservation and greater use of domestically produced renewable energy. These were well-intentioned goals achieved by requiring utility companies to purchase energy from renewable developers under fixed-rate, long-term contracts. Now, however, the energy market has changed, and costs of renewables have decreased dramatically, causing PURPA to serve as nothing other than a hidden tax. Iowa is a national leader in renewable energy, with nearly 40% of its electricity coming from wind. That is up from 1% in 2001. PURPA's mandated long-term contracts have prevented Iowans from realizing the cost savings from new, cheaper renewable energy projects. One study found that utilities have been overpaid by as much as $2.3 billion over the last 5 years, which ultimately gets paid by consumers. Although Congress created PURPA to support small renewable projects, some corporations have hijacked the law to serve their own interests. One Iowa utility testified before Congress that foreign-financed wind developers are just, in quotes, disaggregating the large projects into individual or smaller groupings, end quote. In short, they are manipulating federal rules to get paid for overpriced PURPA-generated power. In one instance, the utility said that this type of manipulation caused Iowa consumers to pay a 20% premium over market prices for a 10-year contract period. Washington cannot allow this to continue, especially now when so many Iowans are struggling financially from this pandemic. One caring Iowa couple even helped pay the utility bills for 11 families having difficulty during the coronavirus outbreak. If individuals can take this type of action to support one another, the government can take swift action to close this loophole. It's encouraging to see FERC, in the middle of this economic fallout, take steps to reduce the financial burden on Americans. For a state as energy reliant as Iowa, efforts like this are crucial to quickly emerging from this economic disaster. And again, that's the guest column by Don Ratchiter. And we have a couple community letters today on the Insight page. This first one is from Diane LeDuc from Iowa City, titled On Different Boats Heading for Different Destinations. We are in the same storm, but not in the same boat. Your ship could be shipwrecked and mine might not be, or vice versa. For some, quarantine is optimal, a moment of reflection, of reconnection, easy in flip-flops with a cocktail or coffee. For others, this is a desperate financial and family crisis. In some homes, a sole occupant faces loneliness. In others, family members are getting peace and time with each other. In others, quarantine means an increased danger due to domestic violence. Some families of four just received $3,400 from the stimulus, while other families of four saw $0. Some were concerned about getting a certain candy for Easter, while others were concerned if there would be enough bread, milk, and eggs for the weekend. Some want to go back to work because they don't qualify for unemployment and are running out of money. Others want to punish those who break the quarantine. Some are home spending a few hours a day helping their child with online schooling, while others are educating their children on top of a 10 to 12 hour workday. Some have experienced the near death of the virus, some have already lost someone, and some are not sure if their loved ones are going to make it. Others don't believe this is a big deal. We are not in the same boat. Our perceptions and needs are completely different. We are all on different ships during this storm, experiencing a very different journey. Again, that's the view of Diane LeDuc from Iowa City. The next letter is from David Johnson of West Branch. This is titled, Face-to-Face Classes on Campus This Fall is Fantasy. While all of us would love to resume face-to-face classes in the fall at the three Regent institutions, the reality of our situation is making that highly unlikely. Let us assume you resume face-to-face classes using the 6-foot social distancing rule. That means classrooms can hold a lot less people. How much less? Suppose you have a lecture auditorium with an area of 8,783 square feet, which has a maximum seating capacity of 760 students under normal conditions. Implementing a social distancing rule would reduce the allowable number of students to 311 students. Size limitations effectively reduces student capacity by more than half. How many students can safely walk down a hallway and use the same exits to leave the building? Is each classroom disinfected between classes? Social distancing practice dictates that no students could share a dorm room. Are universities expected to run these facilities at a financial loss? How long is that sustainable? Will each student get their own shower? In a time when political pressures seem to be fighting against science and facts, it is incumbent upon our institutions of higher learning to stay level-headed. In the absence of widespread testing and immunization, it is simply irresponsible for the Board of Regents, the governor, or university presidents to pretend that we'll go back to a face-to-face learning environment in the fall. It is better to simply make the decision now about continuing with an online curriculum until it is safe for everyone. Again, that's the view of David Johnson from West Branch. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, May 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the other deaths section from Delmar, Robert Bob Fowler, age 81, died Friday, May 1st. being cared for at the Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. In Loudoun, David Butcher, age 63, and Vicky Butcher, age 61, died on Saturday, May 2nd. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is caring for them. From Maquoketa, Leon E. Gibson, age 78, died Thursday, April 30th. He's being cared for at the Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. From Toledo, Pauline Corey Biela, age 84, died Sunday, May 3rd. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo is caring for her. From Vinton, Richard Lee Lindsay, age 83, died Saturday, May 2nd. The Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home in Vinton is caring for his family. From West Branch, Paul Sexton, age 88, died Saturday, May 2nd. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch is caring for him. From West Union, Lois M. Underdahl, age 94, of West Union, died Friday, May 1st. The Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in West Union is caring for her. Ryan W. Ike Eichhorn, age 42, of Cedar Rapids and formerly of Maquoketa, Iowa, passed unexpectedly on Tuesday, April 28th at his home. A private family graveside service and burial celebrating his life will take place on Wednesday, May 6th at Monmouth Cemetery. A private family visitation will be held on Tuesday, May 5th at the Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. A public celebration of life gathering will be announced at a future date. Sonia K. Turner Keenan, age 77, of Marion, formerly of Delhi and Solon, passed away on Friday, May 1st at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private graveside service will take place at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Masonville, Iowa. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is assisting with arrangements. Joan Marie Novak, age 76, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, April 30th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A celebration of life service will be held later when all family and friends are able to attend. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Patricia Pat Montgomery, age 79, of Lisbon, died on Saturday, May 2nd. The private family graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 6th at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Lisbon. Friends and extended family are invited to participate in the service via live stream on Facebook. Search for and join the Remembering Pat Montgomery Facebook group for more information. Arrangements are with the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Diana Lee Scott Frazier of Shelbina, Missouri, passed away on Monday, April 27th in her home, surrounded by family after a four-year battle with cancer. A graveside service was held Thursday, April 30th at Shelbina Cemetery. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Therese Terry Agnes Stewart passed away on May 1st at age 81, surrounded by her family at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Due to state and federal guidance on gatherings because of the COVID-19 pandemic, services will be held at a later date. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Diane Mary Stastny Brown of Swisher. On Friday, May 1st, Diane Mary Stastny Brown, age 72, passed away at St. Luke's Hospital after a courageous battle with mesothelioma. As per the family's wishes, private family services will be held. In addition, a celebration of life will be held at a later time. Brosh Chapel in the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of Diane's services. Juanita Overman, age 79, of Marion, formerly of Spirit Lake, Iowa, passed away on Friday, May 1st at the Views of Marion. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. Due to state and federal guidance on gatherings due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the family will not be having a public funeral mass at this time. A joint celebration of life for Harold and Juanita will be planned at a later date in Spirit Lake. A joint committal service will take place at St. Margaret Cemetery in Spirit Lake. And now we turn to the sports page on high school athletics, an article titled Summer on Hold. High school baseball and softball might start on June 1 or might be canceled. It's by Jeff Linder for the Gazette. The proverbial whiteout has been getting a workout in the office of Aaron Reinhart. In quotes, Reinhart said, "I've spent many hours planning and then replanning due to changing information." Reinhart is the athletic director at Elkader Central. Others figure, why bother? The Edgewood Colbsburg AD Roger Wright said in quotes, "We are just in a wait-and-see mode right now," end quote. Spring sports for Iowa high schools, of course, are off the table. Now, as Wright said, it's wait and see on baseball and softball. Iowa is the only state in the nation that provides high school baseball and softball in the summer. With schools closed through the end of the school year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Iowa High School Athletic Association and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union have pushed the first day of practice to June 1, originally May 4th at the earliest. More than 20 area athletic directors responded to an email sent by the Gazette on Monday asking their thoughts on a summer season. All said that if a season is played, their school will participate. Other than that, who knows? The Cedar Rapids, Washington AD Grant Schultz said in quotes, "The Mississippi Valley Conference officials have heard two scenarios. The first is a start date of practice of June 1 with first competition June 8th. And the second is a start date of practice of June 15th and first competition of June 22nd, end quote. No matter what, the regular season, if there is one, will be abbreviated from its usual slate of a 40-game maximum, maybe drastically. The MVC's summer schedule generally is for a 30-game league schedule for baseball and softball, a doubleheader round robin among the 16 schools. Iowa City West Athletic Director Craig Hugel said in quotes, "We have compiled a shortened summer schedule based on the premise of a June 1 practice start and a June 22nd competition start. We will release that schedule once we get official word that we are having a season," end quote. Another MVC athletic director said on the condition of anonymity, in quotes, "I think you're incredibly optimistic about starting practice June 1. We are hoping for a first day of practice June 15th, games starting June 22nd, and a regular season of 3 to 4 weeks," end quote. The postseason is scheduled to begin July 6th for softball, July 9th for baseball. The state softball tournament is July 20th to the 24th at the Rogers Sport Complex in Fort Dodge. State baseball is July 24th to August 1st at Principal Park in Des Moines. Monticello AD Tim Lambert said, in quotes, "There are lots of interesting decisions to be made if we do have a season, and it's a small window to get games in," end quote. Most area conferences play two league doubleheaders per week. Independence Athletic Director Justin Putz said in quotes, "We are fortunate in the WAMAC that we have 14 teams and a very heavy conference schedule. That also allows us to work very well together to fill out schedules as things continue to change. If the season is not extended and we do not start playing games until mid-June, getting an entire conference schedule in would be difficult. At this point, I think we will all just be glad to be on the field and watching our athletes participate," end quote. Two Tri-Rivers Conference ADs, Lisbon's Eric Reese and Maquoketa Valley's Trevor Arnold, indicated their league will choose a date, maybe June 1, but probably later, and simply cancel the original schedule before the new start date. In quotes, Arnold said, "We all find it hard to believe that the state would let us play games on June 1 with no actual practices before that. If we aren't playing game for a week, 10 days, or until June 15th, in terms of arm health, that should be what we do," end quote. That said, Arnold also added in quotes, "I'm putting the chance we play baseball and softball at about 10%. I hope we are wrong," end quote. Added Tanner Carlson, the AD at Central City, in his quote, "We are hoping for the best for our student athletes to get a chance to play, but also we want to make sure everyone is safe," end quote. And from Solon AD Casey Hack, quote, "Hopefully things improve and we get the opportunity to play this summer. I feel terrible for our kids and coaches," end quote. The South Iowa Cedar League is not a doubleheader conference. If there is a season, Belle Plaine AD Mark Tegler said in quotes, "We'll make a conference schedule in which we will play all schools one time. For baseball, unless the association extends the season, that would be 11 games over 3 to 4 weeks, which would be more than enough with pitching requirements. Softball could look to add some non-conference games and would look to play in Saturday tournaments if those are allowed," end quote. But for now, and probably for a few more weeks, it's wait and see and hope. In quotes, Nathan King, the Williamsburg AD and baseball coach, said, "It sounds like nothing will happen until Governor Reynolds decides if the school closure will be lifted on June 1. This means we may be waiting until June 1 for a summer sports decision. I personally think the longer we wait, the better chance we have," end quote. And next from the sports section, we have an article about junior hockey, the USHL draft staying pretty much the same. Coaches didn't scout players as much during lockdown. This is by Jeff Johnson for the Gazette. From Cedar Rapids, the United States Hockey League conducts its annual drafts today and Tuesday. It's a 3 p.m. start today for phase one draft of players with a 2004 birth date. the Maine Phase 2 draft has a 1 p.m. beginning on Tuesday. This is an online thing, like the recent NFL draft, though the USHL always does it that way, minus the commissioner announcing each pick. That hasn't changed. What has changed is a little more time for league clubs to prepare, since games abruptly ended a month and a half ago because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And there has been a little less in-person viewing and contact with potential draftees. Not that Cedar Rapids Rough Riders coach and general manager Mark Carlson is sweating that thing. In a quote, he said, "Probably like a lot of our clubs in our league, a lot of this starts last June. So I think everybody was able to get out and see a real good amount of live hockey. It's different for sure, but I do think everyone has a good recollection of what they were able to see live," end quote. Carlson, his assistant coaches and scouts will rely on that to build the 2020-21 team. The protected lists for each club are closely guarded secrets, but it's believed Cedar Rapids has 16 players on its. Those are guys who could return this coming season from last season's team, or guys who could graduate from the affiliate roster of younger players. The Rough Riders are believed to have the possibility of multiple returning defensemen and three goaltenders who saw time: Aiden Harper, Andrew Pecora, and Nick Simo. Pecora and Simo were pressed into action late because of injuries to Harper and Delek Malahai, who is moving on to Harvard. Pecora, as a matter of fact, was recently awarded the USHL's Save of the Year in an online vote by fans. Other guys who for sure are going to college include forwards Grant Silanoff, Jackson Judding, and Jordan Tonelli, and defensemen Jack Miller and Darian Gotts. After Tuesday's Phase 2 draft, each USHL team will have an initial roster of 45 players. Carlson was asked if the number of graduates to college hockey this year was affected at all by the pandemic. In a quote, he said, "I don't think that has really changed anything as far as guys returning. The guys who are originally planning on going to school are going to go to school. I haven't seen a ton of difference as far as that goes," end quote. There also isn't a big difference in the amount of pre-draft tenders by USHL clubs. There are 8 of them, though the Rough Riders aren't among clubs that took one. Tenders count as a team's first round, or second round as Tri-City and Chicago tendered 2 players, pick in the Phase 1 draft, with the player having to play in a certain number of regular season games. How post-draft tryout camps are going to work is anyone's guess at this point. Those come in early summer and always provide at least a couple of non-drafted gems for the Rough Riders that make the team and an impact. And then there are foreign players. How will the pandemic affect their desire or ability to come to the USHL? Carlson said in quotes, "There are a lot of questions around how camps are going to go, so we want to try and make sure we do the right things, kind of evaluate as we move forward to make sure we are doing what is right and safe for everybody," end quote. That also can be said about the actual draft itself. In years past, Carlson, his assistants, and a scout or two congregate in Carlson's office, which acts as the club's war room. But it's a cramped space for sure, not exactly safe during these social distancing times. Could you imagine the Rough Riders conducting their draft in Carlson's backyard at home, weather permitting, with everyone in attendance wearing a mask and sitting at least 6 feet apart? Hey, it's not as crazy as it sounds right now. In quotes, Carlson said, "We'll do it a little different. I have some ideas about things, but I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do it yet. We'll be together somewhere practicing social distancing." And another sports article today, this is by J.R. Ogden, "Virtual Crandic is something. Shortcuts not permitted, so don't try any cheating." I haven't run a marathon since, well, it's been so long I don't even remember. My longest run each week these days is 5 miles, 5.38 if I'm feeling extra spunky and the watch clicks 5.0 with a block or two before I get home. But I think I can win the Run Crandic Marathon this year. The third annual Run Crandic Marathon was supposed to be held April 26th, a 26.2-mile race that was going to start in Cedar Rapids this year and end in Coralville. But like so many other sporting events, the coronavirus pandemic with its demands of isolation and social distancing has put a temporary end to our weekend 5Ks and 10Ks, as well as marathons and half marathons. But organizers, knowing the marathon and half marathon are different from these weekly 5Ks and 10Ks and demand months of training, wanted to offer entrants something, anything, for all that prep work. So a virtual race was hatched, with anyone registered able to run the distance on their own and submit their time. Jim Dwyer, a member of the Run Crandic Executive Committee, said in a quote, "It was the best lemonade you could make out of this lemon," end quote. Welcome to road racing in the pandemic era. So how can I win this thing even though I haven't been training or running more than 5.38 miles at a time? Well, in this age of smartwatches, I could easily push the run button on my Apple Watch, jump on my bike, and go for a 26.2 mile ride. I can outsmart the smartwatch. But alas, that would be cheating. It's something the Run Crandic and all virtual road races have to think about. But cheating and running have never really gone hand in hand. I mean, really, who gets cheated? Only the cheater. In a quote, Dwyer said, "Most everybody I've seen, the times are what we would have been expecting." Dwyer knows many of the runners in this area as he is an owner of the Iowa Running Company in Cedar Rapids. All entrants must show proof they completed their distance, 5K, half marathon, or marathon. And most of these smartwatches not only track time and distance, but also map where you ran. Dwyer said the committee figured there would be very minimal chance of cheating. In quote, he said, "Runners are a very honest group for the most part," end quote. The response for this virtual race has been good, Dwyer said. The race started at midnight on April 26th and ends at 11:59 p.m. on Saturday. In a quote, Dwyer said, "We wanted to be as flexible as we could," end quote. Officials hope to have results a week from today and will send out packets with shirts, medals, and other swag by the end of the month. All registrants are available for overall and age group awards. Dwyer said in quotes, "We've had a very small subgroup of people who have complained. A lot of those don't understand. It is standard for races not to issue refunds, but who reads the fine print? For the most part, it's been overwhelming support and understanding and appreciation," end quote. Dwyer knows that nothing beats the real deal, and most runners are missing the social aspect of road races as much as the pre-race jitters and competition with their peers. But we're still running, still getting outdoors, and as Dwyer said, it's a pretty decent glass of lemonade. And also from the sports page, continuing with the sports movies recommendations from the different sports writers at the Gazette, it's Mark Morehouse's turn today, and he has his top 15 sports movies. Number 1, Slapshot. 2, Raging Bull. 3, Rocky. 4, Breaking Away. 5, Heaven Can Wait. 6, The Bad News Bears, the original. Number 7, The Longest Yard, the original. 8, 8 Men Out. 9, North Dallas 40. 10, Miracle. 11, Rounders. 12, Kingpin. 13, Caddyshack. 14, Hoop Dreams. And 15, Murder Ball. And Mark Morehouse writes this a little bit about his favorite movie, his favorite sports movie, Slapshot. Slapshot, true to the sport of hockey. A last place team is folding in a burned out city that itself is being abandoned because 10,000 mill workers have just been placed on waivers. Reg Dunlap, Paul Newman playing the hero, an aging, spent reject of a player coach, feels the pinch. Knowing the Charleston Chiefs are doomed once the mill closes, Dunlap crosses the hockey line, going from straight up, honest, and gentlemanly to goon show. Dunlap massages the gate and the Chiefs' prospects when he uncorks the Hansen brothers, three violent brutes from the hockey wilds of Canada, aka the Iron League. Sure, the Hansen brothers' first shift is cartoonish violence, but it's damn funny. Leaning over the goal and slashing across the face, they just don't high stick like that anymore. There's no empty-headed jock mysticism a la Bull Durham. That's Hollywood. Slapshot is true to the sport of hockey. There's never enough tape, and there's always too much laundry. Or Slapshot is something close to it, something for laughs anyway. Screenwriter Nancy Dowd followed the 1974-75 Johnston, PA Jets, her brother Ned's team, with a tape recorder and came up with a story, profanity and all. By the way, Ned Dowd played Oglethorpe, who still is deported to Canada. This was the 70s, and this was minor league hockey. There is relentless profanity, high-sticking, blood, fighting, Walt making it look mean, a great disco soundtrack, Maxine Nightingale's right back where we started from, and a politically incorrect character named Clarence Screaming Buffalo Swampton. And if nothing else, Newman in a full leather ensemble. And now these Eastern Iowa briefs from the community page. From Johnson County, personal household supplies requested at neighborhood centers of Johnson County. The neighborhood centers of Johnson County is in need of diapers, sizes 2, 3, 4, and 5, baby clothes of all sizes, feminine pads, toilet paper, shampoo, conditioner, dish soap, hand soap, bar soap, laundry detergent, toothpaste, deodorant for men and women, razors, shaving cream, 2 pack-and-plays, 2 car seats, shelf-stable food,
basic kids' art supplies, and all essential items for twins. And that says in parentheses, clothes, blankets, diapers, etc. Message their Facebook page at facebook.com/ncjciowa or email chastitydillard@ncjc.org to make donation arrangements. And from Linn County, special Giving Day event happening Tuesday to support nonprofits. The Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation is encouraging community members, families, and businesses to support nonprofits in Linn County by participating in #GivingTuesdayNow. The Global Day of Giving takes place Tuesday as an emergency response to community needs caused by COVID-19. In quotes, Michelle Besker, who is the Senior Vice President of Development at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation, said, "Nonprofit organizations are facing unprecedented challenges to meet the demand for their services and to sustain their organizations during this time. This day of giving provides a time for Linn County residents to show their support of their community," end quote. On Tuesday, community members are encouraged to give to nonprofit organizations they have always supported and to consider giving to new needs emerging from the pandemic. The foundation opened the COVID-19 Disaster Response Fund in mid-March to provide rapid response grants to help minimize the impact of COVID-19. Since then, the needs have continued to grow. To encourage giving, Toyota is providing a one-to-one match up to $25,000 for donations made for #GivingTuesdayNow. To contribute to the Toyota matching gift, make a contribution to the COVID-19 Disaster Response Fund at the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation at gcrcf.org/donors/waysgive/donate now. For more details about #GivingTuesdayNow, visit now.givingtuesday.org. And from Iowa City, the public library announces updates due to COVID-19 pandemic. The Iowa City Public Library has announced several updates stemming from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The downtown library building will remain closed to the public until further notice. There will be no in-person library programs, public meeting room use, or ICPL bookmobile service until possibly mid-August. Starting today, library staff will resume answering phone calls to 319-356-5200 between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Due dates have been extended through July 15th for everything borrowed from the library. Please keep library items until the library reopens. If items must be returned, the book return of the downtown library is open. There will be summer reading programs for all ages offered online. Look for updates in late May about the new virtual summer reading program, classes, and events. Updates will be shared on the library's website at icpl.org and through social media. All decisions made by Iowa City Public Library leadership right now are intended to keep library users and staff as safe as possible during this pandemic. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, May 4th. I'm your reader, Carrie Craig. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.